This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm news director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll hear from the president and CEO of Adventist Health and Rideout in Marysville about how his hospital is doing nearly 7 weeks into California's stay-at-home order. We'll also hear how two North State colleges are working to figure out the best way to celebrate their graduates, since normal in-person graduation will not be happening this May. And we'll talk flu versus COVID-19. Many people say they have the same risk. We'll hear why one health expert says not so much. If you have questions for us, let us know on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Tuesday, May 5th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. As we get closer to entering week 7 of California's stay-at-home order, we're also getting closer to the time where state and other models have predicted a possible surge of COVID-19 cases in the North State. NSPR's Mark Albert recently spoke with Richard Rawson, president and CEO of Adventist Health and Rideout in Marysville, to check in about how he's feeling for the months ahead and how his hospital is currently faring.
Well, we've spent the last month, or actually a little over the last month, month and a half, preparing for a possible surge, trying to procure as much personal protective equipment as we can get, monitoring that very carefully, and then trying to get more adequate testing available. That's what we've done a lot of. In the meantime, you know, we've canceled, in alignment with the state of California's orders, to not do elective surgery. We've seen overall significant volume decreases as people stay home. And, you know, that's our situation. We see our volume coming, starting to come back. So our emergency department visits are coming back now. And we see those probably up, getting close to up 40% from where they were 2 weeks ago. But still, we were probably half of what we were prior to the state of emergency.
46 cases have been diagnosed in Yuba and Sutter counties. 36 people have recovered and 3 have died. I imagine most have sought treatment at Rideout. How are the doctors, nurses, technicians, janitors, and others handling this crisis?
I think they're doing very well. There was a lot of anxiety initially. You know, people were concerned. No one really knew who had it. The delays in testing. I mean, there was one time 2 weeks ago that we probably had 30 patients that what we call persons under investigation, but pending test results. And it was taking sometimes 5 to 7 days to get back test results. And with that many patients in, you have to treat everybody as if they have it. So that burned through a lot of personal protective equipment, but I would say that the courage of our physicians and our staff has been extraordinary. Their preparation, the innovation they've shown in preparing for a surge that may or may not happen, and then, you know, how they care for patients it's been inspirational to me.
Hospitals are also businesses. To avoid overcrowding, beds were cleared out, surgeries postponed. What has that meant for Rideout and Adventist Health financially?
Well, I think that's been devastating, to the entire industry. I think, we've seen huge reductions in our revenue. You know, the balance of what we do, you know, elective cases are an important part of that. We've had to lay off certain positions, especially some overhead positions. We moved everybody to working from home, you know, flex staff off as much as we can. But, you know, this is going to probably go on for some period of protracted time, and we just need to be prepared for that. Many of our physicians are taking pay reductions as a result as well. So the cost implications have been spread across the organization the best we can. But even that is not enough to overcome the revenue decreases we've seen. So our focus right now is doing everything we can to stay financially strong. And so when this comes back, and as I said, I'm I'm cautiously optimistic that we're seeing many of these come back. I think next week we'll see further relaxation of the restrictions on procedures and surgeries. I'm cautiously optimistic that will come back because we still have a community here to serve. Our sole focus is maintaining our strength, our financial strength, despite this big challenge, not knowing what help we're going to get or not get, but just being positioned to be strong for the future and continue to serve this community the way we have.
There's a strain of animosity in the public directed toward the healthcare industry in the U.S. Is there anything you wish people had a better understanding of in terms of how hospitals operate?
That's a fascinating question. And, I think one of the reasons that's happened is that our industry in general has strayed really away from the relational business it needs to be. It's become very transactional. And, I feel that this, going through this time and things like this always have challenges and there's always opportunities. And I think what happened is that people began to see healthcare workers as a front line in our next war, and that's the war against this pandemic. People who would put themselves at risk, who come to work every day despite the risks and the things they're seeing and reading, but showing that commitment to serve the community. It's really, I think, given us the opportunity to really reposition what we're here to do, and we're here to be an integral part of caring for a community. And our workers are the front line of that, and they've done an amazing job. Mm-hmm. And I think what we owe the communities and what we owe them is really challenging our business models from what they've been in the past and really beginning to figure out how do we do better building relationships? How do we make care more convenient for people? And how do we customize what we do in a way that is much more responsive to not just the clinical needs, but also the social needs?
Adventist also owns Feather River Hospital in Paradise. It's been largely unused since the Camp Fire and sustained some damage. Are there any contingencies under which that facility would be put to use?
We're in an active process right now of evaluating that facility, as well as looking at insurance settlement around that. We got legislation put through the state, thank you to Senator Nielsen and Assemblyman Gallagher, that passed unanimously in the legislature, and the governor signed it, allowing us to operate a freestanding emergency department there. We're in the process right now of going back to CMS to make sure that if we do that, we get adequate reimbursement running it as an emergency department. But at the same time, we're really evaluating the whole facility and saying, are there needs that we can potentially meet, both in that community, but even broader in the North State region that may be going unmet? And so we're evaluating all of those options for that campus right now.
That was Richard Rawson, president and CEO of Adventist Health and Rideout, recently speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. As businesses continue to make hard decisions around the pandemic, so are many colleges, which, like many other industries, have had to cancel or postpone events or take them online. One very tough question for colleges is what to do about graduation, as students have worked for years toward a degree and had planned to celebrate that milestone with family and friends. NSPR's Christian Solis has more on how two colleges in the North State are trying to find ways to safely honor their graduates.
College students in the North State have been through a lot during their time in school, whether it be fires, the Orville Dam emergency, flooding, and now a global pandemic. As a result of the latest crisis, large social gatherings have been postponed or canceled until it's deemed safe to get people together again. And that goes for graduation ceremonies as well. Rachel Simmons works in the University Public Engagement Office at Chico State and explains that instead of postponing graduation for students, they're having an online commencement this year.
It became really obvious that it wasn't safe for our graduates, for our graduates' families, our friends and families who would attend, and for our faculty and staff who participate in commencement, it wasn't safe for us to do an in-person commencement at this time.
Simmons also says that the university is following guidelines from the governor, who has said that he doesn't see large events happening this summer or even this fall.
We wanted to make sure that we could give our graduating class of 2020 a date and a firm date when we really foresee this being able to happen. And we aren't seeing that happening in 2020.
Some other universities throughout California have decided to move in-person graduation to December. But Simmons says Chico State doesn't have an indoor venue that can hold 8,000 to 10,000 people at one time.
An outdoor event in December is really risky, and it could be a very unpleasant experience for the grads, for the friends and family.
Some students at Chico State have expressed frustration about not having an in-person graduation after working so hard toward a degree. Other colleges in the North State are dealing with this issue as well. Shasta College has already moved to an online graduation commencement. Tina Duenas is the director of student life at the college. She says she's hopeful for a good attendance. Duenas says a benefit of online commencement is that it allows for more friends and family to be involved because there aren't any seating limitations and more students might actually show up.
I think because everyone's at home and they are kind of craving that interaction, we have seen greater turnouts for a lot of our events that we've been putting on besides this. So I think it will translate to graduation. Certainly.
Both Chico State and Shasta College say they're eager to celebrate their students and that they haven't received a lot of backlash from their 2020 grads. Tina Duenas says she thinks this is because of the adversity students in Shasta have faced over the past few years, such as the car and campfires. Saying such adversity has
brought people closer together, and I think they're more understanding that there's really things beyond our control. And we just do the best that we can and really, I think they know that about us.
Butte College has also canceled in-person graduation and is currently seeking out alternatives, according to their website. For NSBR, I'm Christian Solis.
You're listening to special coverage about the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. When we're back, we'll hear how those in the reusable bag industry are being hit, and we'll talk flu versus COVID-19. A lot of people like to say the risk of these two diseases is the same. The chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital says, no, they're not. Stay tuned. This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Businesses all over the world have been hit hard by this pandemic, and that includes the reusable bag industry, as many grocery stores are not allowing customers to use reusable bags and are going back to single-use plastic ones. To learn more, NSPR's Mark Albert spoke with Andy Keller, founder and president of Chico Bag, about how his company is managing during this time.
Yeah, as you know, the pandemic started in China. We do 50% of our production in China, 50% of our production in Cambodia, and a little bit in India as well. It's been impacting our production for a while.
I mean, first you probably couldn't get product, and now now that things have abated in China and maybe you can get product, you can't sell them.
Yeah, from our perspective, yeah, that's the situation. And from, you know, our partners that we work with, you know, they're getting hit twice. You know, so they got hit once with the pandemic, and now they're getting hit twice with as the pandemic is spreading around the world and demand's dropping. You know, so it's just very sad situation for workers all over the world, not just in the United States.
Once the pandemic passes, there certainly has been a trend where reusable bags have become more popular and more prevalent, certainly in California, and I think it's a trend that's picking up around the nation. This pandemic obviously interrupts that. Do you see the trends being restored as soon as this is over? Or do you think that this could do some long-term damage to the concept?
I have my hopes and fears. My hope is that things go back to normal, but my fear is, you know, some of these things that are being put in place now are going to be hard to change back to what the way they were. You know, it's important to know that, you know, there is a giant plastic bag lobby, you know, that is using this opportunity, this pandemic, to advance their agenda, which is to take these reusable bag ordinances and, you know, the plastic bag bans that are in place and reverse them. And they have a lot of money that they're putting towards this. And so some of these public health mandates and even at a state level are happening because of the active lobbying of this very powerful plastics industry lobby. The way that we counter that is really demand that common sense practices are kept in place, you know, that help both, you know, humanity and our planet. And reusable bags is one of those. You know, the issue with single-use plastics is that it's used once and it really never goes away. It persists in our environment for eons after we use it. Single-use plastic is kind of the poster child of unnecessary waste. We certainly can use less, and we should, for the health of ourselves and the health of our planet.
Tell me about this challenge or pledge to use reusable things.
It's basically a pledge. It's a pledge that says, hey, I can use less single-use plastic, and I will. I'm going to use reusables wherever I can instead, and I'm going to help others do the same by telling people to use less single-use plastic and to take the pledge themselves.
How's the response been compared to what you'd hoped?
But the initial response has been great. We have a very ambitious goal. So our goal is 38 billion single-use items refused. It's quite ambitious. However, the adoption of reusables is increasing. People are becoming more aware of the threat of plastic pollution as a worldwide crisis. As far as going to the store, you know, one thing you can do is keep your bags in your car, and then bring your, when you're done shopping, bring your cart to your car and bag your groceries in your car.
It's rather ingenious, if, you know, perhaps a little inconvenient, but I think that it's the same amount of work. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, that's a solution that's not obvious, you know, so just bag your groceries at your car, you know, after, you know, if you want to use reusable bags. And then some stores will let you bring your bags in. They just want you to keep them in your cart. And so you can bag your groceries in your cart as well after your checkout. I guess the third tip is, you know, you can buy a new reusable bag. If you're in the market for a bag, there's no reason why you couldn't buy a new one at the store and have your groceries bagged in a new one. The basic thing is, you know, buy a reusable bag that's washable, if that's a concern of yours, and sanitize it, your bags, like you would anything else.
That was Andy Keller, founder and president of Chico Bag, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. If you'd like to learn more about the F Single Use campaign to pledge to prioritize more reusables, head to chicobag.com. During this pandemic, you've likely heard or seen someone compare COVID-19 to the flu. saying things like the flu is just as deadly, or even that the flu kills more people than the novel coronavirus, which at the time of this recording has taken the lives of more than 62,000 people in the United States. CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Ruyak, last week spoke with Dr. Dean Blumberg, the chief of pediatric infectious diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital, about why saying COVID-19 is like the flu is not really a fair comparison.
Let's talk through some of what the perception is out there about flu versus COVID-19, the death rate in particular in this disease, and what you've come to believe now.
You know, I see the comparisons between the two, and I think it's a distracting to me. And so I think, you know, coronavirus is this brand new virus causing excess mortality. People are dying from it and getting ill from it. Flu's been around forever. We're all sort of used to that, and I think we sort of get, sometimes we just get inured to it, that we're going to have a flu season every year. People are going to get the flu. The vaccine works part of the time. It's not the best vaccine that we have out there, but it does help, and that people will die from flu. We're kind of used to that, and we accept that, and coronavirus is brand new. So I think comparing the two is sometimes it's not useful, because they're two completely different infections.
I know you're speaking from the medical side of this. Should the picture of flu and what it's done in this country and how we've managed it be used then in policy decisions that are being made about COVID-19?
Well, I think what we know that influenza is a respiratory virus, and so in that way it's similar, and we know the burden of disease that it does cause, and we've accepted that. We've accepted that, the CDC, the estimates that I've seen is somewhere between 12,000 and 60,000 people are going to die every year. Maybe we shouldn't accept that. You know, maybe we need to be pushing for higher immunization rates, and we shouldn't accept all those deaths every year. You know, that in the U.S., between about 10 and 45 million people get influenza every year. But that is something that we do accept. Influenza vaccine is not mandatory. It's recommended. We try to encourage people to get it. But, you know, with a lot of the things we're seeing with coronavirus, they are mandatory, the social distancing, the closing of businesses, et cetera. So we have taken a different approach because it is novel and because everybody is susceptible.
Well, let me flip that around and get your opinion on this. Some people believe that just as we do with the flu, we should just know it's coming and simply live our lives, not shut down our economy, and accept that some of us are going to get it, and in time we will know how to manage it and cure it.
Yeah, you could do that. That's going to result in millions of deaths. So I believe that that's just very, very cold attitude, and I don't agree with it at all.
How dangerous is COVID-19 then at this point compared to the flu?
Well, we think somewhere between a 0.5% to 4% of people who get COVID-19 will die from it. And so that's why it could lead to millions of deaths in the U.S. And everybody is susceptible to it. You compare that to flu, where some people have been immunized, some people already had the flu and they've recovered. And even in a bad influenza year, we don't get death rates. We don't get the number of deaths compared to what could happen with COVID-19.
Along the lines of the way we have these quick tests for flu and for strep throat, what do you know about antigen testing and the number of companies working on it?
And I know that they're being developed. I haven't seen good data about their reliability yet. Obviously, when we have any of these tests roll out, we want to be able to depend on them, and we want to be able to trust the results. Some of them have been reported to have preliminary accuracy of only 80%. Now, 80% is better than 0%, but still, you really wouldn't then trust a test that was negative, because you might be missing 20% of the cases. So, you know, to me, that's really not good enough.
Are there more medications, remdesivir being one, more therapies that are emerging and are being tested in the UC Davis health system right now as something that might be effective? There are some indications, Dr. Fauci commented on it overnight, that a drug can work against COVID-19, which alone is a big piece of news in the world right now.
Yeah, so the remdesivir studies, the results that were released yesterday were promising. I mean, they did show about a 30% faster recovery time. And so that's great. What we have not been seeing, though, is more dramatic effects, such as decreased viral shedding and really preventing patients from dying, which is the ultimate goal. So we'd really like to have even better drugs, but we'll take any progress at this point. Even incremental progress is good.
Can you weigh in on this number, the 25 days versus the 2 weeks to 8 weeks versus, you know, whatever other data is available right now in terms of point of infection to people who have lost their lives in the case of COVID-19?
Yeah, so the studies do vary, and so I guess I wouldn't pin it down to an exact number because the initial estimates were from China, and some people were getting into the healthcare system relatively late in the course of their illness. And then there's different estimates from Italy, and then different estimates from the U.S. But it's anywhere from about 2 to 4 weeks from time of first symptom onset to death when that does occur. And obviously, if you have more heroic measures that are occurring in the hospital, you can prolong life, but ultimately the patient may die anyway.
You and I have been working on health-related information for a lot of years, Dr. Blumberg, and I think I'm just going to be very open about this and take whatever answer you give me. But are we focusing on the right things enough of the time? Are we directing people in the right ways that from your healthcare setting you believe are important and will save lives?
I think we're trying. I'll put it that way. I think we're trying very hard to do that, and there's a lot of distractions along the way. There's a lot of science deniers out there who say things like we should just open up the economy, it's not that bad, it's a hoax or whatever. And, you know, that's not helpful. That's distracting, and that distracts from the message. I think, you know, I'd like to think that we're all good members of the community who want to protect each other by social distancing, et cetera. And yet you have these people who are already against the vaccine. We don't even have a vaccine, and they're already saying that it's dangerous before it even exists. So you can't deny some of this stuff. You can try. You might not want to believe it. But I think that was one of the problems early on with the U.S. response was we didn't test enough. And one of the issues is if you're not testing, you don't know it's there. But that's like walking around with your eyes closed. So we need to have our eyes wide open. We need to get good data. We need to believe the science when it's good science. And the junk science, we need to just throw that away and not get distracted by those kind of messages. I mean, you don't have to believe in gravity, but, you know, gravity's there whether you believe it in or not, and the science is there whether you believe it in or not related to COVID-19.
That was Dr. Dean Blumberg, the Chief of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at UC Davis Children's Hospital, recently speaking with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Rujak. And that is your program. If you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is special coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30. Or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.